Welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, April 16, 2024. I'm your reader, Marcy Davis. Here's our first story from the Mason City Globe Gazette. Humane Society marks 65 years of uniting pets with companion people. The Humane Society of North Iowa marks a milestone this month, celebrating 65 years of matching families with companion animals. An open house was held April 6th for people who have adopted a pet or are searching for a companion that can provide a forever home. Executive Director Sybil Sukup welcomed visitors as they entered. Staff were decked out in Humane Society t-shirts, ready and willing to answer any questions guests could think of. Attendees could meet Elaine, a domestic short-haired cat who has called HSNI home since last May. Her typically laid-back attitude means she'd be well-suited to a home with regular routines. Also on hand was Aurora Jean, a female bulldog mix who has been at Humane Society since June 2021. They say that she's had some quirks that have made her a little challenge to place. She's a funny lady. She's slow to warm up to people, so she needs someone who is willing to spend a little extra time with her here in the shelter. She's not friendly with other animals either. She's a particular girl. Longtime volunteer Jerry Koresh spends a few extra minutes each day with some of the shelter's long-term residents. He walks Aurora Jean regularly. Sukup says volunteers have a soft spot for pets who don't find their forever homes right away. Miss Aura is a little spoiled. She laughs. She gets a weekly trip out for McDonald's cheeseburger, no onion. Staff just loves her to pieces. Alice Ann Blackmore founded the Humane Society of North Iowa in 1959 on her farm near Mason City, according to a press release. Blackmore found homes for and provided care to many animals. In 1986, a former veterinarian's office on North Federal Avenue in Mason City was purchased by David and Phyllis Murphy and gifted to the Humane Society. Eventually, the demands of the organization outgrew the building and more space was needed. The McNider family donated 6.5 acres of land on Birch Drive to the HSNI to construct a new facility in 2006. In the summer of 2009, after completion of this facility, Alice Ann Blackmore was one of the first to take a tour and see her dreams had finally become a reality. Blackmore died in November 2013, but her legacy continues in the work that is done for the animals. The Humane Society of North Iowa is considered one of the Iowa's largest no-kill shelters, meaning that animals are not euthanized based on the length of time they've been in the shelter or due to lack of space. Adoption data going back to 1986 show the Humane Society of North Iowa has found forever homes for more than 13,000 displaced animals. The Humane Society of North Iowa is located at 2700 Birch Drive in Mason City. Call 641-423-6241 for more information. Again, that number is 641-423-6241. Mason City's Blue Heron Bar and Grill to be featured on show. A local Mason City restaurant will be hosting camera crews this week to film an episode of America's Best Restaurants Roadshow. The Blue Heron Bar and Grill was nominated by customer Mary Ann Alaskason, who praised both the homemade food and the staff. America's Best Restaurants, a national media and marketing company, brings national attention to local independently owned restaurants with its roadshow, highlighting popular dishes and interviewing the co-owners. "I just wanted to say thank you," said Vicki Lau, who owns the Blue Heron with her husband Mike. "When I look back at day one, we said, let's just see if anyone comes in. It's never stopped. The whole experience has been very humbling." The Blue Heron opened in August 2017 on North Federal Avenue in Mason City, cementing itself as a popular neighborhood restaurant almost immediately. With support from local clientele, the eatery has flourished, and it was even able to stay open throughout the difficult years of the COVID-19 pandemic. Mike Lau attended the culinary school in Portland, Oregon, where he and Vicki met before moving to Mason City. The pair opened the Blue Heron, offering homemade comfort food with varying and rotating menu, full bar, and many popular dishes and specials. The restaurant offers many favorites, all homemade, such as their tenderloin, fish, meatloaf, and their ultra-popular Bloody Marys. Kitchen lead Sean Lau said he is excited about filming Thursday and grateful for the customers who have given the restaurant the ability to both stay open and now share their product with a larger audience. When I first found out we had been selected, I thought, this is awesome and an honor to represent Mason City, Sean Lau said. Honestly, I was shocked, but that just shows how your hard work can pay off unexpectedly. Since its opening, Vicky said, Blue Heron has made promises to the neighborhood to keep the place an upstanding and positive environment, making sure all are welcome to a good homemade meal. Our community has been awesome, and they really rallied behind the local businesses, and we made it through COVID. So we love to support our community. Vicky said the majority of the restaurant's advertising dollars go towards supporting youth sports in Mason City, like the baseball diamonds and the parks and the rec soccer. The restaurant also has hosted fundraisers for people in need. The community aspect of Blue Heron is both special and paramount, Sean Lau said, and the restaurant likes to show its appreciation with special events every year. That's the thing about us. We want to be here in the community, Sean said. Having a harmony between quality service, quality food, and quality community is part of the reason the Blue Heron has been selected for the show, Vicky said. If you have above average food, but your service isn't good, the customer won't come back. If you have mediocre food, but the service is amazing, people are apt to try it again. We try to make sure customers have double reasons to come in. We just treat people the way you want to be treated. Sean says there's a connection between Blue Heron staff and its patrons that comes from constant discourse. We like to listen to the community, and they help us pick our specials. It's not just our place. We like to be open to our customers' ideas. The environment and the food complement each other. It all goes hand in hand. The episode's premiere date will be announced on Facebook and will be available on to view the America's Best Restaurants website. My husband had a dream to open his own place. It's a very hard business. It takes a lot of dedication and perseverance, Vicky said. We're working on year 7, and that comes with the support of our family, our friends, and the community that comes back. Lake Concert Association presents Folk Rock Show. The Clear Lake Area Concert Association will present the folk show Feels Like Home with Tina at 7 p.m. Saturday in E.B. Stillman Auditorium, 1601 3rd Avenue North. The final show of CLACA's current season, Feels Like Home, celebrates 1970s female rockers such as Linda Ronstadt, Stevie Nicks, Carly Simon, Joni Mitchell, and more, according to a press release. Tina has performed for Disney Cruise Line at the Utah Shakespeare Festival and in various off-Broadway shows. She has also toured the country as lead singer of a band called Honolly. Single event tickets are $25, or the show can be attended as a bonus with a purchase of 2024-2025 membership. Memberships or tickets may be purchased at the door at the show at Clear Lake Area Chambers of Commerce, 205 Main Avenue, or Grabinski Law Office, both in Clear Lake, or on the CLACA website at clearlakeconcerts.org. For more information, call 641-529-1964. Detour delays underway at County Road B35, Lark Avenue. Travelers entering Mason City from the west have been experiencing delays on a detour route as part of Highway 122 East in the vicinity of Indian Head Drive. And it's closed for the foreseeable future while construction crews work to replace a bridge. An Iowa Department of Transportation press release states, while eastbound Iowa 122 is closed, you will follow a marked detour route by traveling south on Lark Avenue for 1 mile, east on 255th Street, 19th Street, southwest for another mile, and then returning to Iowa 122 on Eisenhower Avenue. During this project, you'll be able to access businesses along Iowa 122 between Lark and Eisenhower Avenues while traveling on either direction. The construction is a partnership of multiple agencies. Social media posts over the weekend raised complaints about the wait at the intersection on Lark and B35. Traffic on B-35 does not stop, and Black Hawk County Supervisor Chris Watts suggested at Monday's meeting that the DOT investigate whether a four-way stop at the intersection is needed. County Engineer Brandon Billings offered to immediately forward the request to the Iowa DOT. The city and the county are working together to maintain detours as the bridge is being repaired. The South Bridge is currently under construction, and plans are in place to repair the North Bridge following completion of the first repair. Construction timelines are set at approximately 2 years for both bridges. Opinions. Simpson kept running, never got past his greatest escape. When we picture scenes from the life of O.J. Simpson, we see him running away from pursuers, from justice, from his own demons. A compelling and tragic lifetime of flight came to an end Wednesday with Simpson's death from cancer at age 76. The juice is loose no more. On football fields, Simpson ran away from tacklers with breathtaking speed and agility. He first achieved fame as one of the greatest running backs in history. At the University of Southern California, in 1968, he won the Heisman Trophy. Drafted by the NFL's Buffalo Bills, in 73, he became the first player to rush for more than 2,000 yards in a season. He was elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. None of that fully captures the thrill of watching Simpson run. A linebacker would be bearing down on him inches away, and suddenly he would zigzag left or right, or both in succession, and he was gone. His running was charismatic. When he added the sparkle of his million-dollar smile and the polish of his perfect diction, he was irresistible. Everyone loved O.J. In his most famous TV commercial for Hertz Car Rental, he ran through the airports just like he had run through defensive lines. Simpson made an instant transition from football star to Hollywood star. He was in the Towering Inferno. He was in the landmark Roots TV series. He played Detective Nordberg in 3 Naked Gun movies. He hosted Saturday Night Live. But then in 1994, he got into a white Ford Bronco and ran from the brutal, bloody killings of his ex-wife Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ron Goldman. The ensuing low-speed chase on Los Angeles freeways was captured live by TV cameras and broadcast around the world. That night, I was watching the NBA Finals when coverage of the game was interrupted for the breaking news of the Bronco chase. At first, I was annoyed, but then I was riveted. All of that was mere prelude, of course, to Simpson's greatest escape of all. As theater and as a legal circus, Simpson's murder trial has never been surpassed or even equaled. Its characters were vivid to the point of being undeniable. Eager to please Judge Lance Ito, dutiful but overmatched, prosecutors Marsha Clark and Christopher Darden, slick and razor-sharp defense lawyers Johnny Cochran Jr. and F. Lee Bailey, house guest Brian Cato Kalin, Simpson friend and counselor Robert Kardashian. He was the beginning of all things Kardashian. Racist detective Mark Furman, in a non-speaking role, the bloody glove. Throughout his career as a football player, actor, and celebrity, Simpson had avoided saying anything about issues involving race. He reportedly used to tell friends, "I'm not black, I'm O.J." Indeed, he was so beloved because he was seen as non-confrontational and non-threatening. Faced with the prospect of spending the rest of his life in prison, however, he embraced his blackness. His professed new racial consciousness allowed some black Americans to at least consider the possibility that he was yet another black man being brutalized by a racial justice system. After all, the trial was taking place just 3 years after the L.A. riots, sparked when the police officers who savagely beat Rodney King were judged to have done nothing wrong. The evidence against Simpson was overwhelming. Even though the murder weapon, a knife, was never found, the trial took 11 months. The jury took less than 4 hours to reach its shocking verdict, not guilty. I have not a bit of doubt that he committed the murders. In 2007, Simpson even had the gall to write a book, If I Did It, which he said was a hypothetical narrative of how he would have committed the crime, wink, but of course he didn't. In 2008, Simpson was convicted in Las Vegas of armed robbery and other charges, connected with what he claimed was an attempt to recover some stolen sports memorabilia, and given a harsh 33-year prison sentence, which struck me as akin to a referee's makeup call correcting a previous error. But he was released on parole in 2017, and he spent the rest of his healthy years playing golf. It was a diminished life, to be sure. He had just a fraction of his one-time wealth and status. His celebrity was one of the most tarnished kind. His need for adulation would never be requited. He was a pariah. But O.J. Simpson died a free man. He zigged and zagged all his life and never quite got caught. Here are the obituaries for Tuesday, April 16th. Melva Adams LeBlanc. Melva Adams LeBlanc passed away peacefully on March 23, 2024, in Mesa, Arizona. She was born on October 26, 1931, in Liberty Township, Mitchell County, Iowa, to Sidney and Vera Weiner. As a youth, Melva was active in 4-H in the church youth group. She enjoyed sewing and helping other family on their farm. After graduating from Little Cedar High School, she worked as a telephone operator for Northwestern Bell. Melva married her high school sweetheart, Howard Adams, in 1950 in Little Cedar, Iowa. They welcomed 2 children and farmed in Iowa before moving to Arizona in 1963. Melva worked as a secretary for Grace United Methodist Church in Mesa Public Schools. Her church was an important part of her life and a place where many friendships blossomed. After 38 years of marriage, Melva's beloved husband, Howard, passed away in 1989. She married her second husband, Lee LeBlanc, in 1997. Melva enjoyed reading, researching family histories, sewing, traveling, gardening, dancing, birdwatching, playing games, and most of all, spending time with family and friends. Her spunk and strength were demonstrated in hiking to the bottom of the Grand Canyon twice. Melva was preceded in death by her parents, Sidney and Vera Weiner, her first husband, Howard Adams, her second husband, Matthew Lee LeBlanc, her brother, Carol Weiner, and his wife, Pauline. She will miss by her loving children, Richard, Brenda Adams, and Diane Randy Lewis, 3 grandchildren, 4 great-grandchildren, and her brother, Larry Dortha Weiner, and several other family members. A celebration of life will be held at the St. Ansgar United Methodist Church in St. Ansgar at 11 a.m., on Saturday, April 20th, 2024, memorial donations may be made to the St. Jude's Hospital or your local church. Jenny Lewerke Forshee. Jenny Lewerke Forshee, 103, of Britt, passed away on Monday, April 8th, 2024, at Concord Care Center in Garner. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, April 16th, at Ewing Funeral Home, 178 Center Street West in Britt, with Pastor Greg Baum officiating. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 on Monday, April 15th, at Ewing Funeral Home and continue 1 hour prior to services. Jenny Lewerke, daughter of Harm and Jenny Miller Lewerke, was born on September 8, 1920, in Parkersburg. She was one of 10 children. When she was in 6th grade, Jenny's father passed away. She had to quit school to help her mother and siblings at home. Jenny worked hard and later in her life to receive her GED. On February 10, 1944, Jenny was united in marriage to Lynn Forshee at his parents' home in Britt. They moved to Athens, Georgia, and later to Hawaii. In 1947, Lynn was honorably discharged from the Navy, and they made their home in Britt, where they raised their family. Jenny was a member of Bethel Baptist Church in Britt, where she served on various functions. She loved her Lord, family, and church. She enjoyed sewing and even taught her daughter, Sylvia, and neighbor Carol how to sew. She was very creative and enjoyed arts of all kinds. Jenny and Lynn loved to travel all over as well as paying visits to their children and extended relatives and friends. Jenny is survived by her children, Gary Forshee and Marlene Ronald Meckenstock, step-grandchildren, and many nieces and nephews. She is preceded in debt by her husband, Lynn, in 2007, infant son, Alan Lee, her parents, nine siblings, Pete, Ella, Jake, Elzo, Susan, Gert, Harm, Rose, and Eileen, brother and sister-in-law, Don, Ellen Forshee, and many aunts and uncles. Ewing Funeral Service, 178 Center Street West, Britt, Iowa. Their phone number is 641-843-3839. Bonnie Marie Powles, February 28, 1943 to March 28, 2024. Bonnie Marie Powles, 81, formerly of Britt, passed away on March 28th in Waverly, Iowa. A massive Christian burial for Bonnie will be celebrated at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, April 19, 2024, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church, 139 3rd Street Southeast in Britt. Burial will follow at St. John's Catholic Cemetery in Duncan. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, April 18, 2024, at Ewing Funeral Home, 178 Center Street in Britt, with a rosary and reflections beginning at 7 p.m. Bonnie was born in Duncan, Iowa on February 28, 1943 to Raymond and Dorothy Kopachek. She grew up on the family farm and attended Britt High School. While in high school, she participated in dance competitions around North Iowa. After high school, she raised her family in Britt. Sundays were often spent on the farm with her children, parents, and siblings, or visiting aunts, uncles, and cousins nearby. Bonnie was a devoted mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother who showed her love through handwritten cards and letters, long phone calls, shared laughter and food, especially Bonnie's baked beans, bran muffins, and monster cookies. A woman of faith, she was an involved member of the St. Patrick's Catholic Church, serving on parish council, supporting fellow parishioners, and fostering her own spirituality through Catholic Daughters of the American and Rosary Guild, teaching religious education, sharing the Word of God as a lector, and singing in the choir. Bonnie lived the lessons she wanted her children to learn. Be grateful for what you've been given, do your best with what you have, share your gifts with others, and find good in people and situations. Bonnie was a dedicated employee working at Kelly Real Estate for 40 years. She retired in 2019. Bonnie lived most of her life in Britt and was proud of her hometown. She enjoyed playing cards with friends, delighted in the bright colors of her flower beds, and was committed to her daily walk, often picking up trash along the way. She enjoyed dances at Duncan Hall, cheering for the Minnesota Twins, and was an active supporter of West Hancock High School sports. She enjoyed the community activities and caring staff at Summit House in Britt. As her dementia progressed and she needed memory support and skilled nursing, Bonnie moved to Bartles Lutheran Retirement Community in Waverly. She spent her final months surrounded by their warm and compassionate care. Surviving family members include her children, Sean Foy and his wife Lori of Elko, Minnesota, Chris Foy and his wife Mary of Waverly, Natalie Techtmeyer and her husband Dan of Chandler, Arizona, Eric Foy and his wife Kim of Dubuque, Tony Foy and his wife Carrie Nogard of Eugene, Oregon, Nicole Varnado and her husband Brandon of Durham, North Carolina, and Joe Powles and his wife Tiffany of Belmont, Iowa. 25 grandchildren, 6 great-grandchildren, a brother, Tom Kopachek, and his wife Jenny of Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, and several nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, sisters Beverly Hiscox and Mary Ann Kopachek, brother Reverend Jerry Kopachek, and many aunts and uncles and cousins. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made in Bonnie's memory to the St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Britt or the West Hancock Schools. Ewing Funeral Chapel, 178 Center Street West, Britt, Iowa. Their number is 641-843-3839. This week in history. April 16, 2013, two bombs explode in crowded streets near the finish line of the Boston Marathon, killing three people and injuring more than 270 in a bloody scene of shattered glass and severed limbs. Earlier in the day, Lalisha Dasia of Ethiopia won the 117th edition of the marathon, and Rita Jeptu of Kenya took the women's race. This is Memory Lane in April 16th. 1940, Cleveland's Bob Feller defeats the White Sox 1-0 in Chicago in the only opening day no-hitter in the major leagues. In 1958, Arnold Palmer edges Doug Ford by one stroke to capture the Masters. 1980, Arthur Ashe retires from professional tennis. 1990, Jalinda Borden becomes the first Olympic men's champion to win the Boston Marathon. The Italian finishes in 2 hours, 8 minutes, 19 seconds. Rosa Mota of Portugal wins the women's division in 2 hours, 25 minutes and 24 seconds. 2001, Lee Bong-ju of South Korea wins the Boston Marathon, ending a 10-year victory streak for Kenyan men. Kenya's Catherine Netterbaugh wins the women's race. 2003, the Washington Wizards' Michael Jordan plays his final NBA game. On April 17th in history, 1939, Joe Louis knocks out Jack Roper at 2 minutes 20 seconds of the first round in L.A. to retain the world heavyweight title. 1947, Jackie Robinson bunts for his first major league hit. 1951, Mickey Mantle makes his major league debut for the New York Yankees. 1976, Mike Schmidt hits 4 consecutive home runs and drives in 8 runs as the Philadelphia Phillies overcome a 13-2 deficit to beat the Cubs 18-16 in 10 innings in Chicago. In 1982, the Denver Nuggets, Alex English, Dan Issel, and Kiki Vanderway each averaged 20 points a game, the first front court to do so since Bob Pettit, Cliff Hagin, and Clyde Lovellett of St. Louis in 1961. 1983, Nolan Ryan strikes out his 3,500th batter. In 1995, Wayne Gretzky reaches 2,500 career points when he sets up a power play goal by Rob Blake in the Los Angeles Kings' 5-2 loss to the Calgary Flames. In 2001, Barry Bonds becomes the 17th major leaguer to hit 500 home runs. Bonds' 8th inning drive off of Terry Adams leaves the San Francisco Giants over the LA Dodgers 3-2. You are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Marcy Davis. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger. Altman gets 35 years for shooting death and other crimes. Courtroom mainly interrupts sentencing hearing Monday. A sentencing hearing that sent a convicted killer to prison for decades briefly turned into a fracas of yelling and shoving when the slain man's father suddenly rushed across a Webster County courtroom toward the defendant Monday morning. A large group of law enforcement officers quickly restored order and removed the distraught father. When the hearing resumed, Quantarius Altman, 19, of Fort Dodge, was sentenced to a maximum of 35 years in prison for killing Adrian L. Grover, 18, of Fort Dodge, on May 13, 2023, plus 2 crimes Altman was convicted of before Grover's death. Altman shot Grover in the chest with a handgun at about 2:45 a.m., May 13, 2023, in the 1000 block of 10th Avenue Southwest, according to court records. He also pointed a gun at a second individual and made a threatening statement to them. He was quickly apprehended when police stopped a car matching the description of one spotted leaving the scene of the shooting. When he was arrested, Altman was initially charged with first-degree murder and first-degree harassment. On March 1st, he pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter while armed with a dangerous weapon, willful injury causing serious injury while armed with a dangerous weapon, and possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. Those were among the charges Altman was sentenced for on Monday. Iowa allows survivors of a homicide victim to make impact statements during a sentencing hearing. Grover's father, Edward E. Brown, was the first to make such a statement during Monday's hearing. He walked to the witness stand at the front of the courtroom carrying a framed poster-sized photo of Grover wearing his graduation gown. He began a short, profanity-laced statement. Turning to where Altman sat shackled in jail uniform, Brown said, "Look at me, blank, blank." Suddenly, Brown put the photo down, stood up, and began walking towards Altman. Friends and relatives of both Altman and Grover jumped to their feet and moved toward the front of the courtroom. Altman was hustled out of the room by a jailer, while other jailers, Webster County Sheriff's deputies, and Fort Dodge police officers moved in to separate everyone. District Court Judge Angela Doyle stood up behind the judge's bench and ordered the law enforcement officials to clear the courtroom. Brown was escorted out of the courtroom and out of the courthouse. His yelling and swearing echoed through the building's central staircase as he left. Iowa Assistant Attorney General Ryan Baldridge, the prosecutor in the case, said he would be consulting with Webster County Attorney Darren Driscoll about the possibility of filing charges in relation to the courtroom upheaval. After a break of 10 to 15 minutes, the hearing resumed. Grover's mother and sister gave victim impact statements without incident. Then Doyle issued the prison sentences. For the crime of voluntary manslaughter while armed with a dangerous weapon, she sentenced him to 10 years in prison. For the crime of willful injury causing serious injury while armed with a dangerous weapon, she sentenced him to 10 years in prison. For the crime of possession of a firearm by a prohibited person, she sentenced him to 5 years in prison. For a May 8, 2023 conviction of possession of a firearm by a prohibited person, she sentenced him to 5 years in prison. For a May 2023 probation violation, she sentenced him to 5 years in prison. Doyle ordered the sentences to be served consecutively. That means Altman will serve a maximum of 35 years in prison. Doyle said that the long prison sentence provides the best chance of rehabilitation, protecting the community, and deterring others from committing the same crimes. AP source: ship that caused bridge collapse had apparent electrical issues while docked. This comes from Baltimore and the Associated Press. The massive container ship that caused a deadly collapse of a Baltimore bridge experienced apparent electrical issues before it left port, but set out anyway. Someone with knowledge of the situation told the Associated Press on Monday, hours after the FBI said it was investigating whether any laws might have been broken. The Dolly left Baltimore's port early on March 26th, laden with cargo destined for the Sri Lanka, when it struck one of the Francis Scott Key Bridge supports, causing the span to collapse into the river and sending 6 members of a roadwork crew plummeting to their deaths. 3 of their bodies have been recovered. The Dolly experienced apparent electrical issues before leaving port, according to someone with knowledge of the situation. The person who spoke on the condition of anonymity, because they weren't authorized to comment, said alarms went off on the ship's refrigerated containers while it was still docked in Baltimore, likely indicating an inconsistent power supply. The ship's crew was aware of the issues and indicated that they would be addressed, according to that person. Officials with the National Transportation Safety Board have said their investigation will include an inquiry in whether the ship experienced power issues before starting its voyage. Lending a helping hand. FDSH students spearhead Winnie Foster Project to help those in foster care. This is written by Chris Johnson. Alexa McHone wanted to start a tradition at Fort Dodge Senior High, one that will continue to grow. This year's project was inspired by a story she heard this past winter. A man was taking a walk on the beach, and he saw a child throwing starfish into the ocean. McHone said about the story that she heard this winter. The child said, "If I don't throw them in the ocean, they will die." The man said, "There are thousands of starfish, and you're just a kid. You can't make a difference." The kid picked up another starfish and threw it back into the ocean. "I made a difference for that one." For the second straight year, McHone will be part of a group spearheading a project to help throughout the community. Together, McHone, a junior, along with junior Courtney Hoover, and freshman Lauren Patterson are leading the Winnie Foster Project. Last year, McHone was part of the service project that collected donations to support the Lotus Community Project shelter. This year, during FDSH's three shows of Tuck Everlasting, students will be collecting donations for the foster care system. By using the platform that the musical provides, we are able to make a difference for the people in our own community and hopefully inspire others to do the same, McHone said. When I started organizing community service projects to go with the musical, my goal was to start a tradition that will continue to be carried on after I leave. I'm very grateful to be able to work on this again, and I am excited to see what will happen with this year's project. When Patterson was asked to help, she quickly jumped at the opportunity. When Lexi and Courtney asked me to help with the project, I knew I wanted to help. I thought it was a good way to help others who aren't as lucky. We chose to collect donations for foster care since through the show, Winnie grieves the loss of her father. The project will accept any donations but is also looking for specific needs. We're looking to collect new blankets, new stuffed animals, small pillows, books, African-American skin and hair products, toothpaste, toothbrushes, hairbrushes, and other personal hygiene projects, Patterson said. It means a lot to give back to the community because I've been really fortunate and I want younger kids to grow up and be as fortunate and give back as well. Hoover also saw the need to help those in need. I got involved with this project because I wanted to start getting involved with the community more and more because I think it's a good way to connect with people and help out at the same time. I was in the musical last year and saw how well the community service project went for Lexi, and I knew that I wanted to help her out this year. We brainstormed what community service project we were going to do this year and came up with the Winnie Foster Project. Throughout the 3 years from Thursday through Saturday, April 18th through April 20th, at the Fort Dodge Middle School, students will accept donations as part of the Winnie Foster Project to help kids grieving the loss of family. Items can be dropped off in the high school choir room or in the middle school lobby before all the shows. The goal is to fill a van full of items. 13-year-old girl shot to death in Eldora on Sunday. A 13-year-old girl was fatally shot in a rural area of Iowa, and a 12-year-old boy was taken into custody. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation said someone called 911 just before 5:30 a.m. Sunday about the shooting in the town of Eldora, about 80 miles northeast of Des Moines. The girl was found at home. The name of the girl killed and the boy taken into custody were not released. No details have been released about what led to this shooting. The DCI is investigating. South Hardin School Superintendent Adam Zellmer said in an email to the community that the school district was shaken by the death. Here are the obituaries. Carl Grawl. Carl D. Grawl, 92, of Fort Dodge, passed away Thursday, April 11th at the Simpson Health Center, Friendship Haven. A mass of Christian burial will take place at noon, Friday, April 19th, 2024, at Holy Trinity Catholic Church. Burial will follow at North Lawn Cemetery with military rites by the U.S. Air Force and VFW Post, 1856. There will be a visitation on Friday from 10:30 a.m. until the time of service at the church. Lofsweiler Funeral Home is serving the family. Carl is survived by his children, Carl Grawl Jr. and his wife Patty of Colorado Springs, Colorado, James Grawl and his wife Katie of Eagan, Minnesota, Kevin Grawl and his wife Babin of Boone, 8 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren. Carl is preceded in death by his wife Beverly, parents John and Rosella Paulson Grawl, brothers Robert and Charles Grawl, sisters Bernice Eldridge, Madonna Freud, and Betty Heidick, and granddaughter Amanda Grawl. Carl D. Grawl was born on September 29, 1931, in Fort Dodge. He was raised and educated in Fort Dodge, graduating from Fort Dodge Senior High School in 1951. He served in the Air Force during the Korean War. He served 4 years of active duty and 4 more years in the reserves. On January 24, 1959, he was united in marriage to Beverly Meehan at Holy Rosary Church, and the couple established their home in Fort Dodge. Carl worked for the city of Fort Dodge as a police officer, making his way up to a captain. He retired in 1989 after 32 years. He was a member of the Holy Trinity, the Eagles, NRA, Fort Dodge Pistol Club, and Good Sam's. Carl enjoyed fishing, hunting, and working in his shops. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Russell Williams. Russell P. Williams, 64, of Fort Dodge, passed away Saturday, April 13, 2024, at his home. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday, April 18, 2024, in the chapel of Lofsweiler Funeral Home. Burial will follow in Memorial Park Cemetery. A visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at the funeral home. Gordy Scott. Gordy Scott, age 84, of Pocahontas, passed away on Saturday, April 13, 2024, at the Sanford USD Medical Center in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Funeral Mass is 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 20th, 2024, at Resurrection of Our Lord Catholic Church in Pocahontas, with Father Paul Wynn officiating. Burial will take place in Calvary Cemetery in Pocahontas, Iowa, with military rites by American Legion Liberty Post No. 18. Visitation is from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, April 19th, at Powers Funeral Home in Pocahontas. Powers Funeral Home of Pocahontas, Iowa, is handling the arrangement. This date in history. This is by the AP. Today is Tuesday, April 16th, the 107th day of 2024. There are 259 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history. On April 16th, 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote his letter from Birmingham Jail, in which the civil rights activist responded to a group of local clergymen who had criticized him for leading street protest. King defended his tactics, writing, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." On this date, in 1889, comedian and movie director Charles Chaplin was born in London. In 1972, Apollo 16 blasted off on a voyage to the moon with astronauts John W. Young, Charles M. Duke Jr., and Ken Mattingly on board. In 1977, Alex Haley, author of the bestseller Roots, visited the Gambian village of Jufur, where he believed his ancestor, Kunta Kente, was captured as a slave in 1767. In 2003, Michael Jordan played his last NBA game with the Washington Wizards, who lost to the Philadelphia 76ers 107-87. In 2007, in one of America's worst school attacks, a college senior killed 32 people on the campus of rather Virginia Tech, before taking his own life. In 2013, NFL player turned broadcaster Pat Summerall died in Dallas at the age of 82. Your morning coffee may be more than a half a million years old. That coffee you slurped this morning, it's 600,000 years old. Using genes from coffee plants around the world, researchers built a family tree for the world's most popular type of coffee, known to scientists as Coffea arabica, and to coffee lovers simply as coffee. The researchers, hoping to learn more about the plants to better protect them from pests and climate change, found that the species emerged around 600,000 years ago through natural crossbreeding of two other coffee species. In other words, prior to any intervention from man, said Victor Albert, a biologist from the University of Buffalo, who co-led the study, these wild coffee plants originated in Ethiopia, but are thought to have been first roasted and brewed primarily in Yemen starting in the 1400s. In the 1600s, Indian monk Baba Budan is fabled to have smuggled 7 raw coffee beans back to his homeland from Yemen, laying the foundation for coffee's global takeover. Arabica coffee, prized for its smooth and relatively sweet flavor, now makes up 60 to 70% of the global coffee market and is brewed by brands such as Starbucks, Tim Hortons, and Dunkin' Donuts. The rest is Robusta, a stronger and more bitter coffee made from one of Arabica's parents, coffee Canephora. To piece this together, Arabica coffee's past, researchers studied genomes of the Canephora, another parent called coffee eugenoids, and more than 30 different Arabica plants, including a sample from the 1700s, courtesy of the Natural History Museum in London, that Swedish naturalist Carl Linnaeus used to name the plant. The study was published Monday in the Journal of Nature Genetics. Researchers from Nestle, which owns several coffee brands, contributed to the studies. The Arabica's plant population fluctuated over thousands of years before humans began cultivating it, flourishing during warm, wet periods and suffering during dry ones. These lean times created so-called population bottlenecks, when only a small number of genetically similar plants survived. Today, that renders Arabica coffee plants more vulnerable to diseases like coffee leaf rust, which cause billions of dollars in losses every year. The researchers explored the makeup of one Arabica variety that is resistant to coffee leaf rust, highlighting sections of its genetic code that could help protect the plant. Police log, Fort Dodge on Sunday. A domestic disturbance was reported at the 300 block of North 10th Street. Shots fired were reported in the 200 block of Avenue M West. A person with a gun was reported in the 10 block of North 10th Street. A hit-and-run accident was reported on the 800 block of North 3rd Street. Trespassing was reported in the 10 block of North 25th Street. An assault was reported in the 2400 block of Highland Park Avenue. A suspicious person was reported in the 200 block of South 25th Street. A vehicle accident was reported in the 2700 block of 5th Avenue South. Criminal mischief was reported in the 1000 block of 3rd Avenue Northwest. A disabled vehicle was reported in the 2800 block of 5th Avenue South. Debris in the road was reported in the 1400 block of 2nd Avenue South. A fight was reported in the 200 block of North 12th Street. A welfare check was conducted at 2nd Avenue Northwest and Hawkeye Avenue. Harassment was reported in the 1400 block of 7th Avenue North. Criminal mischief was reported in the 1900 block of 2nd Avenue North. An assault was reported in the 300 block of G Street. Down power lines were reported in the 1200 block of 17th Street Southwest. Theft was reported in the 2300 block of North 15th Street. An animal was struck by a vehicle at Kenyon Road and Avenue East. A noise disturbance was reported in the 1300 block of 4th Avenue South. A suspicious vehicle was reported at 17th Street and 12th Avenue South. In the Magistrate Court, Webster County, on Monday, sex offender registration violation, second or subsequent offense, Gary L. Jensen, Fort Dodge, preliminary hearing waived. Driving while license suspended, Karina N. Hirschman, 28, 1557 Nelson Avenue, $250 plus surcharge and court cost. Christina L. Markham, 46, Des Moines, $250 plus surcharge, court cost. Violet M. Nelson, 24, at 1002 South 33rd Street, $250. Tayden Hooper, twenty years old, at 1624 First Avenue, $250 plus surcharge. Operating while under the influence, first offense. Michael J. Wagner, 41, Jefferson, preliminary hearing set for May 3rd. Domestic abuse assault, first offense. Benjamin A. Jones, 40 years old, 2412 Highland Park Avenue. Trial is set for May 15th, no contact order issued. Interference with official acts. Cammy Hilton, 29, Fort Dodge. That's continued for 180 days. Assault causing bodily injury or mental illness. Dante D. Whitfield, 26, 308 Charles Street. His preliminary hearing is set for April 25th. Failure to provide proof of financial liability. Christina L. Markham, 46, of Des Moines. $325 plus surcharge and costs and court costs. Curfew violation. Chantel Woods, 37, 907 South 15th Street, $105. Here's some area scoreboards. Two more wins for the Stags. This is in Ames. The Fort Dodge Rugby Club earned two more victories at the Ames Invitational to keep their recent momentum alive. The Stags easily took care of the Iowa City West, 47-0, and Ankeny Centennial, 31-0. Pushing their win streak to four consecutive matches. PAC edges Humboldt. The Pocahontas Area Girls Golf Squad defeated Humboldt on Friday 211-217. Nicole Panbecker was meet medalist for the Indians, carding a 46. Teammate Delaney Jansen, 49, was runner-up. The Wildcats were paced by McKenna Mathis, 51, and Aries Packard, 52. Ace for Jashke. Cody Jashke recorded a hole-in-one at the Fort Dodge Country Club on Saturday. He aced the 153-yard eighth hole with a pitching wedge. The shot was witnessed by Cole Jashke, Randy Stoltz, and Tony Trotter. Clean sweeps at home for Southeast Valley Track Squads. The Southeast Valley Track Squad and field teams swept the team titles here Monday night at the Jaguar Relays. The Jaguars held off South Central Calhoun in both races for team gold as Jace Hansen swept the hurdle events with Cameron Lane winning the 400 and then Southeast Valley Boys the 4x100 relay. Meanwhile, the Titans claimed 12 event crowns, including two from Iris Melody, who swept the distance events. Tristan Gordon, shot put, Wyatt Mernke, discus, Ashley Schlesman, discus, Andrew Anderson, high jumped, Reg Potts, 3,200 meters, Chloe Judish, 800, and Brock Natras, 200, were also winners. South Central Calhoun won the 4x800 sprint medley and distant medley relays for girls. Newell Fonda's Lindsay Wolf, high jump, and Isabel Bardick, 100, and the girls, 4x100, were crowned winners. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm Marcy Davis.